Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I was in so much pain. I refused all treatment, anything possible, because my condition was really severe and I was losing so much weight. And I was in so much pain that I was literally pregnant and I would just collapse on the ground. And my husband would say, "Baby, let me move you to the couch." Like, and I was, "No, just leave me here. Just put a blanket over me. I can't move anymore. I can't." And my husband's, "Come on, you have to fight. You have to keep going." And I looked at him and I said, "I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I can't keep doing this." And, I will never forget his face because he was so let down. And he was, "No, it's okay." And for him, he said, "It's okay, baby. Like, I have enough faith and I have enough strength for the both of us. I'll carry you."
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA Special Agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to part two of this week's episode. I'm sitting here sweating. If you saw yesterday's interview, you know why. If you didn't see yesterday's interview, go listen to it before you listen today, because it's not going to make sense, because we're going to take up right where we stopped yesterday. Tony's just been, this is our guest this week is Tony McBride, former LAPD police officer, second 2.5 years on the job, gets involved in an officer involved shooting, legitimate shoot, thanked by other people on the scene for saving their lives. And then the public gets involved, and then the media gets involved, and then the people that conduct investigations and the hierarchy of the police department get involved. It's just going downhill. So let me just say here, Tony, welcome back. First of all, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me. This has been, honestly, even though I've been crying a lot, thank you for having me. You are so easy to talk to, and I'm happy to be sharing my story.
Excellent. And truly, I'm honored and proud that Game of Crimes is the platform you chose to tell your story. She told me some stories about another interview that she did where they couldn't even get her name right. I mean, how hard is that?
It's only 4 letters. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. So I just want to start by saying that a lot of people don't realize that when you're involved in a police officer shooting, that their life changes overnight. I mean, it starts at the time when that adrenaline is starting to do a dump on you, whether it's when you're leaving the scene or when it's just to get to the station and you've had a time to sit down and kind of collect your thoughts, or maybe when you get home. But it does it to everybody. It's done it to me. I've gone to shooting sites as a supervisor where I had 4 guys shoot at a bad guy. Thankfully, they won. Had one guy that had been involved in an officer involved shooting before and was taking a nap in his car. I had two guys that were shook up visibly, but were okay. And then the fourth guy, we had to take him to counseling right away just because it's that serious of an event. So you hear us laughing a little bit. I mean, Tony's getting emotional and crying over some of the things she had to go through, and I don't blame her at all. You may see Murph tear up here because, you know, you guys know I get emotional the older I get. I just hate to see people who dedicate their lives to help their fellow man be crucified when they did nothing wrong. It just, and there's, other than bringing you the truth here on the podcast, there's nothing I can do about it. So that's why I'm going to continue to bring these heroes on here for you. Okay. Having said all of that, now give us an idea of, you mentioned yesterday, Tony, that it was, you were at the station probably 9 hours before they took your statement.
Right.
So
right.
If you can just kind of explain to us how that investigative process goes, and what your personal feelings were, your nerves as this process is ongoing. Because I know, even though we know we did things right, you're always still a little bit nervous.
Right. So, oh gosh. So they took us back to the station, and it takes a long time for them to actually process the scene, to get FID out there, to get everybody's statements. It takes a very long time. And then they interview the shooters or the officers involved. They take their statements almost at the very end. So I remember finally taking my interview. I think it was at midnight or 1 a.m. the following day. And my shooting happened at around maybe 5:30 in the afternoon. Jeez. So it was terrible. And they take everything from you. They're like, yeah, don't look at the news, this and that. So you're just kind of sitting there replaying everything in your head, second guessing yourself. You're like, did I actually see that? Did I make that up? Did I hear this? Was that not there? So you're just sitting in the station and everyone's bringing pizza because everyone knows it's going to be a long night. And I'm like, I can't eat. I'm going to throw up if I eat. I have no appetite. And what's crazy is that I remember, because again, you're with that sergeant until you're going home, basically. And I remember telling him, hey, I'm going to go use the restroom. And I don't know if other officers have done this, but I remember going to the bathroom and just looking at myself, looking in my eyes in the mirror. And almost, I was kind of looking to see if my eyes were different, if I had lost anything, because I just told myself I just took a life. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror and trying to see if there was anything different about myself, if I still had life in my eyes, basically. And it's funny, you're talking about this with you. It's really bringing up a lot of these memories. I've forgotten about that. And so I do my interview and then I think I was home at 3 or 4 in the morning. And I think, I can't remember, but I remember I had to tell my mom because I still lived with my parents at that time. I'm trying to save money, guys. It's hard out here. Like, I had just turned 23. I had just turned 23 about a week prior, and then my shooting happened. So I don't care what people say. Like, my parents are awesome. Yeah. So I remember, I believe my mom stayed up until I got home, and she was just in tears. She was like, I have no idea what happened. All I know is that you're involved in a shooting. And I'm, no, I'm okay. It's all right. I'm all right. All right, I'm gonna go to bed. And I remember that first night I got home, that was the last night that I ever got full sleep, because every day after that, I couldn't sleep. And I was having a really difficult time just processing everything that's happening, being in the news, all the hate going on. So they do the interview, I get home, and then the next morning, I believe I went to the station because I was reporting for duty. And keep in mind, all of these protests, these riots are happening in LA. Like, it was in the heart of everything going on. So all of those things that you saw in LA with the riots, burning down buildings, cars, fireworks, being thrown at officers, I was there. So I actually did another shift, and then I remember they were like, okay, hey, I know you guys just pulled 12-hour shift. We need more officers to go downtown because there's huge riots. Who wants to stay? And I'm like, send me, because I knew that if I gave that up, I was going to be missing out on like once in a lifetime, like opportunity. Like, right. Who gets to say that they were involved in the like frontline riots of Los Angeles? Send me, I'll do it. So I remember, I think it was probably a week maybe after that, I pulled another, it was a 24-hour shift, which for police officers, that's a long time. Usually it's just 12-hour shifts.
Right.
But it was insane. Like, I remember working the scrimmage line. My helmet doesn't fit me. I have a peanut-sized head. My dad makes fun of me. My dad's, is there any knowledge in there? Your head is small, girlfriend. I get it. So you see this big helmet on me. It's bobbling around. And I'm just, oh my gosh, please just stay on. And I remember we were taking fireworks thrown at us, frozen water bottles. Everybody was getting injured, but it was so, I don't know how to explain it. A lot of people probably would have been scared, but as police officers, we almost, of course, we run towards danger, but we also love the adrenaline. We live off of it. So I was just stoked to be there. Like, then they announced, hey, if you guys don't leave, to the protesters, if you don't leave the area, you're going to be arrested. And then all of a sudden they're like, all right, guys, pick a body. And that's how it is when you're on the scrimmage line and you're working with a partner and you're taking a suspect or a protester into, I'm going to say a rioter because they weren't protesting. When you're taking a rioter into custody, you basically have to tell your partner, all right, we're picking that individual. And then you're just like, all right, let's go, hands on. And then you got to pull them back and it's insane. And then, of course, I remember when we took a bunch of rioters into, I'm sorry, I'm already laughing. We took them into custody. Well, we used this building, like an apartment complex. Next thing I know, from the fourth or fifth, you know, story, they're throwing things at us. So then as soon as we realized that, oh my gosh, we used the 40s, we used everything, and we launched them into their apartments, into their windows. And then they shut up real quick after that when they realized we weren't playing. So, but that was fun, right? I was, oh, okay, this is what it's about, helping the city and all this good stuff. So then I go home and I'm like, okay, whatever. And then the news breaks out and they got my name. They figure out who I am, and then they link it to Terran Tactical Innovations, which is me training as an officer. Now, I'm just asking you guys, would you want an officer to train on their days off to be really good at shooting so they can have accurate shots and be proficient with firearms? Or do you want the cop that doesn't train at all? And then we're like, all right, situation, boom, you have a suspect here who has somebody, and what are you going to do? What would you choose? It doesn't make sense. The LA Times will say, officers need more training. Oh, but she trained too much. She trained way too much. Have you heard of that before?
No.
Well, you heard it here, because apparently I trained too much.
That's a first.
That's a first, yeah, for the LA Times. Okay. So I was seeing that in the news, and it's funny because during this time, I was working with a bunch of companies, and I remember it was probably less than a month. I had to do a photo shoot with Dillon Precision. I love that company. Guys, if you want to back a company that truly supports officers through and through, go and support Dillon Precision and Dillon Arrow, because they were like, whatever you need, we're there for you. And about a week after that, the owner of the company called me, Mr. Dillon, and he goes, yeah, we're getting a lot of news reporters calling and they want the photos. They want an exclusive about you, this and this. Like, and all he said was, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to tell them F off? Do you want me to, what can I do to help you? And I was, tell them to pound sand, sir. And he goes, done deal. And there I'm like, go. That's my guy. I will say this. I've never mentioned this before. And again, I don't care. I'm leaving everything out there. But the company 511, I'll still wear 511 only because I have it and I'm cheap and I'm not going to go out and buy another brand because I'm trying to save money here, guys. I use coupons. I go thrifting. So, but when this happened, the owner, but somebody very high up in 511 called me because I was going to do projects with them. And they said, hey, we just can't work with you right now. You're too controversial. We just can't work with you at all. But hey, give us a call when everything else settles. But yeah, we just don't want to touch you.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Can you believe that? 511, who is so diehard, pro law enforcement, pro first responder. And for them to say that to me, I was like, oh, okay. I was like, that's a wake up call to me. I was like, no problem. I was like,
wow. Hey, you're done with them at that point, right?
Yeah, I don't support 511. Again, you'll see me wear some of their stuff because I just have it, but I don't support them. I don't, their message and the people that are running 511, I do not support them because of that. And if it happened to anybody else, I would still take that with a grain of salt. But, and I'm not like doing this because I hate them and blah, blah, blah. I'm just telling you guys, it's up to you if you still want to support them. Behind the scenes, guys, they care about their image.
There you go. All right. I mean, that's great information there. And not to go off on a tangent here, but the shirt I'm wearing is made by LA Police Gear, which supports the Southern California Gang Conference. So if you're looking for a good company out there in LA for, which I believe are beautiful shirts, you can see their embroidery here. A great job they did. Fantastic place. So check them out. Got the thin blue line flag on the sleeve. So, but let's get back to your story. The commercials are over. How surprised were you by the public criticism and the negative media? I mean, did you expect that or was it just a complete shock?
I think the public was more upset that my dad, that I had a relation with my dad. Because if you know my dad, he's very outspoken. He's always in the news. He's criticizing Democrats. He's criticizing anything that is in support of criminals. So when my name came in the news, it was almost like I was a way to get to him. And it didn't matter what happened. Even if I was stabbed or if I got severely injured, no matter what, I don't think it was going to make a difference. And I think the public was going to make up their mind based off of who my dad was. And they just hated the fact that I trained a lot. I trained a lot on my days off, and it was just ammunition for them.
Well, you know, I mean, what business is it of theirs? I mean, first of all, you're bettering yourself at your chosen profession, but what is it? What do they want you to go hang out in a bar and become an alcoholic?
Right. I mean, that's what I'm sorry to say, but most cops do that. A lot of them don't know how to deal with the stress. So it's either they have an addiction to alcohol or they find other things that are just not healthy for them. But for me, my outlet was shooting, and it was diving into that and knowing that me training every single day, it was preparing me to save a life. And because of that woman who said, "Thank you for saving me," it helped me a lot with the criticism, because whatever the noise said, I know for a fact that I saved a life that day. I know I saved multiple, but to have her say it, I carried that with me, and I will carry it with me until the day I die, for sure.
I love it. I love it. And I certainly hope she's listening to this. I doubt that she is, but if you are, thank you so much, because you helped Tony get through this, you know, and there's no better feeling when you're doing your job than somebody from the public comes out and either claps for you as you're taking a suspect down the street or just stops to say thank you for what you do. Because it doesn't happen very often.
No.
None of us got in this job to get the pat on the back. But it's just like whatever job you have, when your boss says, "Hey, good job," that means a lot.
It does. It really does. And it's funny because I was never told in the department, "Thanks for doing what you did." Or I was never told that. I had people say, "You know, you did a great job with what you had in front of you. And how do you basically address the situation?" I had people say that, but I was never told thank you for what you do, which is kind of weird, I guess, because you wouldn't really say that to another officer. But I don't know, it's just kind of, having her say it to me meant everything to me, and I carried it. When I'm about to tell you guys what happened to me after the shooting, you're gonna basically wonder, like, wow, why the heck did you stay on for that long?
Yeah. So let's just get into that. What did the LAPD does their own shooting investigation? What were their findings, and were there any disciplinary recommendations that went with it?
So for me, I believe, so we did the, what's it called? The use of force. I'm sorry. It's been so many years. So please forgive me, guys. And to be honest with you, I've just tried to forget it all because I don't want to carry that weight with me anymore. But we had the use of force review board, and that was about 6 months or so. It was about 6 months after the shooting. And it was funny because when they were doing it, they weren't even focused on me. They were, where was the partner? The partner should have been there. And I was like,
"You think?"
And I'm just sitting there, because during this proceeding, you as the officer involved cannot say a single word. You're not there to testify. You're not there to say your piece. You're there to shut up and listen. So I'm just sitting there and I'm just wide-eyed, like,
You got the same questions.
Yeah, I got the same questions. So they were mostly kind of hounding my partner, because even they realized too, they're like, well, maybe if the partner was there, they could have tried less lethal. They could have tried other de-escalation tactics, but my hands were tied. People do not understand that. I was alone. When you have an edged weapon that is approaching you, as a police officer, you have to choose equal force or higher force. You cannot choose something that's lower than that. So with a sharp edged weapon charging at me, you're not going to use less lethal. You're going to have to use a gun or something else. Yeah, RPG. I don't know, man. But during that process, they actually told me that they ruled that all of my shots, they were correct. They were in policy and there was no problem there. The only problem that people really hold on to, because people always say, "Oh, her shooting was out of policy, this and that." The department ruled it in policy. Everything that I did was in policy. Then it goes to the Board of Police Commissioners, and it is run by liberals who have zero police training. Nobody understands this. So it does not matter what the COP, Chief of Police, says, or the Use of Force Board. No matter what these people say and their recommendations, which even the COP at the time agreed that I was in policy, doesn't matter. It is the Board of Police Commissioners that decides, and they ruled that my last two shots were out of policy. Yet, they have zero police training, but the ruling is always down on them. So when they had ruled it out of policy, then it goes back to the department for a disciplinary action. The departments, they already ruled it was in policy. So they're kind of, this doesn't make sense. It's in policy. So at the end of the day, they just said, okay, you're going to have, I guess, more training. And guess what, guys? I liked it. I like training. So sucks on you. So,
bring it on.
Bring it on. So, but with that being said, I went to this training and of course my partner is there. I have not seen or talked to my partner since that day. Never. He never reached out to me, never checked in on me. So I remember we're going to this training and I'm just sitting there and I'm okay, whatever. And then he sits next to me and I'm, oh, I'm going to talk to this guy. Just you wait. So at the end of the day, I remember I was like, hey, we're walking to our cars. Hey, you got a second? And I didn't unload on him because I'm trying to be respectful and I'm trying to
understand.
I'm trying to understand. And I honestly, I just need a lot of closure because I've never felt that scared or more alone before in my life. It truly was the scariest thing because I always thought there was going to be a partner next to me. So I just asked him, I was, where were you? What happened? And he goes, oh, well, I took a second, didn't see the suspect, and I saw people that needed some aid. So I went over there to help them. And I'm like, well, I needed some help too.
Yeah.
Where were you at? And of course, now I'm a little bit more joking about it. But at the time, I was not laughing. I was very emotional. Again, it was still 6 months. And during that 6 months, guys, it wasn't a, oh, I'm just going to keep working patrol. I'm in the news. It's fine. I'm just going to wait for my hearing. It wasn't like that at all. In fact, I worked the riots. And then it was some time after that, I got called. Oh, and keep in mind, there were protests about me in South Central. Protests in front of the station. At the shooting site, there was a poster of me that it said, Tony McBride, killer cop. And it was a big ass photo of me posted, basically greenlighting me. And it was terrible. And it was up there. Nobody took it down, which really annoyed me. For months, it was up. So I remember one day, they were like, hey, there's too many protests. We just can't have you. Oh, and you'll think this is funny. I actually never told anybody this. So the protests are happening just for BLM. So I sign up. I'm like, yeah, send me. All good to go. I already did a 24-hour shift before. This is a simple one. No big deal. So we get there. We're staging. I had about 3 P3s come up to me and we're just waiting. And they go, hey, come on. We got to talk to you. And I'm like, what's the problem?
What's a P3?
A P3 is a training officer, so they have stripes.
Okay.
So they pull me out of the shop trying to be a little more discreet. I'm like, what's up? What's wrong? And they go, hey, just to give you a heads up, we're not going to tell the sergeant. We're going to leave this up to you because this should be your decision. And I'm like, okay, what's going on? The protest that we're about to go to, it's actually your protest and your face is plastered everywhere. If you want to go to it, we'll support you and we'll protect you. But just keep in mind that if you go, you're probably going to try to get lynched. And lynching means you're going to be pulled from the crowd into the crowd, and then you're going to get beat up and maybe die. And they say, but we're going to leave it up to you. This is your decision. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh. And I'm like, well, how did you guys find this out? They're like, well, we've been monitoring it online because everyone's posting about it. And I was, oh, shoot. And I'm like, okay, I have two decisions. I can tell the sergeant, I'm going to look really weak and basically, you know, say, oh, I'm too scared. So just pull me back to the station and risk that. Or I can stay, I can fight and help. But if I stay and if I'm recognized, then I'm potentially putting other officers in danger trying to protect me. And I will never have an officer ever get hurt because of me. So I thought about it. And thank God, the sergeant that was taking care of our unit that day, he was the same one that found me after the shooting. He was the first one that took care of me and I love him to death. Mm-hmm. And so I went up to him and I was like, hey, this is what's going on. I was like, I really don't know what to do. I don't want to just leave everybody to look lazy, but I also can't have other officers be injured. And he goes, nope, you're going. See ya. And I'm like, all right, well, that's settled. So I get back to the station and I'm just walking around. I'm bored. I'm monitoring everything on the screens. And I'm like, oh my gosh, sleeping inside. And then so I end of shift, the next day comes, I did about half of a shift. And then next thing I know, I'm being called into the captain's office. And I was, why? I'm not a bad kid. I'm going to detention or something, right? The principal's office. So I'm okay. So I'm like, sir, what's up? And he goes, hey, so how's everything going? And I'm like, how's everything? I'm in the news. I'm getting, you know, I'm
crucified.
There's protests about me. And I'm like, I'm doing great, sir. What can I do for you? And he goes, okay, well, just to let you know, you're going to be going to Northeast Division. And I go, oh, okay. For like a day, they need an extra unit. Sometimes divisions will do that. They'll lend other officers. And he goes, no. You're going to go there and you're going to be transferred. So go up to your locker, clean it out right now, and you're going to report to Northeast Division tomorrow. And I'm like, oh, okay. And he goes, yeah, get all your equipment, go. And then before I left that meeting, I was, okay, so are you, like, I still have public contact, right? I can still work patrol, no problems. And he goes, yeah, don't worry. You're totally fine. I'm like, okay. So I get trash bags and I'm just cleaning out my locker and I'm just, I'm like, okay, I'm just, you're in a daze right now. What's happening? And then I have other partners seeing me load up my car with all my stuff. And they're like, hey, McBride, are you good? What's going on? And I was like, I don't really know. They just transferred me to Northeast Division because of all the protests about me. And they think that it's like danger. Like I basically people are going to be waiting out front to shoot me. So I guess I'm going. And they're like, oh, okay. And people are asking me, like, are you going to try to come back? I'm like, well, yeah, absolutely. I don't want to leave. I've never wanted to work Northeast Division. There's some amazing officers there, truly, but I never wanted to work there. I actually hate Northeast Division. I said it. It's out there. I said it.
Oh,
I hated it. So the next day I report to Northeast Division. I'm in roll call for patrol. And I know they do the whole lineup and they're like, okay, anybody who I didn't call? And I'm like, the new kid. Hey, I know and it's mid DP. So if there's any transfers, it's usually at the end of the DP, not in the middle. So it was really, so that's already a red flag for other officers. Why is this person here? That's an admin transfer. What happened to you? Where are you here? So I'm like, sir, yeah, admin transfer. And they're like, yeah, no. It looks like you have no public contact and you're supposed to be detectives. And I go, I asked my captain and he said, and they're like, yeah, no, he lied to you. He actually signed this document saying that you're not supposed to have public contact.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I'm just steaming, right? I'm like, wait until this. Like, so I'm calling the union to represent me. I deserve to work the field. I worked hard for my job. I'm not a house mouse. Get me back out there. So while that's happening, I had somebody who I met in high school. I played basketball with them and I haven't talked to her probably in 5 years, but she still had my phone number. So I'm upstairs in the detective's room and I get a text from her and it was a screenshot of my home address being blasted all over Twitter. And she goes, hey, I'm really sorry. I know we haven't talked in a while, but I just want to give you a heads up that your home address is being released and spread all over Twitter. And she's been to my house before. So she knows that's my address.
Whoa.
So when I see this, the first thing I thought of was my mother, because even though everybody in my family is law enforcement, she's a civilian. And at the time, now she knows how to shoot and defend herself. I made sure of it. But during this time, my mom is just the most innocent person you could ever think of. It's a truly innocent person. And so I just get immediately, oh my gosh, how long has this been up? This has been up for a couple of hours. And I'm like, I'm just now seeing this. So I go into the lieutenant's office. And at this point, I did not care what happened to me. I was like, I don't care. I'm going home. So I quickly tell him, like, my home address is being released. My mom is at home by herself. I'm leaving. Goodbye. And he goes, whoa. I'm like, I don't have time for this. I'm going. Send a unit to my house right now. I'm leaving. So I get in my car and I'm racing home. I'm trying to call my dad. I'm trying to call my mom. And again, I still lived with my parents at the time. So I call my dad. I'm like, Dad, they released my address. Like everyone's going to go there. I'm really scared someone's going to hurt mom because I'm not there right now. And he goes, don't worry, I'm going to call the deputies right now. So get off the phone with him. I'm calling my mom. I'm telling her, get inside the house, lock the doors. Don't go near any of the windows. Just try to protect yourself. If anybody comes to the door, don't answer it. Monitor all the cameras. And I get there and thank God that there was already a deputy there because my dad had called them. So thankfully there was a deputy there, just making sure everything was safe. And I remember, if you guys have ever heard of fight or flight, I was constantly in a fight mode. And ultimately, that's what caused my disease, because now I have an autoimmune disease, which we'll dive into. So later on down the road, it was later that night, as an LAPD officer, if something like that happens to you, you get assigned R100, which means basically, Metro has to stay with you and your family for for me, it was, I believe, three nights, two days, or four nights, something like that, 24/7. And so I remember being so scared. And I remember, like, I had a couple of guns and I was, "Mom, this is what you're going to use. If you're in this room, use this gun. If you're in this room, I'm going to set one in here for you." So I started basically like creating my own compound, being prepared for anything that was going to happen. I was so, I don't want to say ashamed, but I was just so upset that I had brought this danger to my front door, because us as police officers, we are running towards danger to help other people, but we never really expect it to happen at your front door because of what you did on the job. So I just remember feeling really kind of antsy and anxious because I was just so constantly looking over my shoulder. And even when I left the house, I had to be escorted by Metro to help me get to places. And because, again, everybody that I grew up with was wanting to sign a petition to throw me in jail. And so my address was blasted all over Twitter every single day for 3 weeks. We finally got it taken down. And again, I was just scared. Having Metro there really helped me relax, because I remember I was looking out my back window and I remember seeing two of the Metro guys out there with, I think it was Benelli's. And I remember seeing that and I was like telling myself, okay, you can relax. You don't have to protect the house. You don't have to protect everybody. Relax. And I remember I actually slept that night knowing. And then when they had actually left, that's when the anxiety, that's when everything came back, just being worried about my mom. And it was a really tough time. I was so stressed.
Yeah. And let me just say right now, you did not bring that danger to your family. You were out doing your job, a job that your dad does, that your uncle does, that your sister now does. And these jackasses out there brought it on you. So I just don't, you know this, Tony, but I don't want you to carry that guilt feeling, because it's not, that was not caused by you. It was caused by that jerk that had the knife that came after you in the street. And then it was extrapolated unbelievably by a bunch of uneducated, uninformed people who are just looking for any excuse to cause chaos, anarchy, and mayhem in our world. That's all that was. I know that's a burden on you, but you know, for what it's worth, coming from an old has-been, that wasn't your fault.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's tough to hear it. But believe me, I wish I had heard that back then, because that would have helped me a lot.
Well, you got more sleep, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So the shooting happened in April, and then the protests, everything in the news, everything you could think of was in May. That's also when I was R100. So when that started happening, that's when I started to realize my body was getting really sick. And I wasn't hospitalized. So I'm the type of person, again, I don't like bothering people. I hate asking for favors. So I started to notice that my body was starting to get really, really sick. But I didn't tell anybody and I kept it really private, because to me, I just kept telling myself, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for this. I'm focusing on my parents. I need to make sure my mom is safe. I have the two lawsuits now from the suspect's family. I'm getting admin transferred. I have no public contact. I have no idea what's going on. I have all these death threats, everything possible. And I was like, I don't have time. I don't have time to go to the doctor. Well, fast forward to October of 2020, I get hospitalized, and I've actually never come out and said it, but I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, which, if you're familiar with it, your intestines bleed from the inside due to stress, and it's extremely painful. You lose a lot of weight. Sometimes you can't keep a lot of food down, so you're either vomiting it up. You become malnourished, depleted in everything, iron deficiency, anemic. You name it. Like, it's, and the pain is so excruciating. And I remember telling my parents finally, because I was so skin and bones. I remember telling my mom, I was, hey, I don't think something's right. I'm really sick. And she, I don't want to say she found me passed out on the bathroom floor because I was so malnourished, but there were times where she would find me. And she would just say, like, do you need anything? Like, can I help you? Like, what do I need to do? Do I need to take you to the hospital? And I was like, nope, I can do this. I can do this. And then I ultimately got diagnosed with it and I got hospitalized. It's kind of sad, but what helped me so much cope with that was my dog, Danny boy, my little Australian shepherd, because I would be passed out on the bathroom floor. You're up all night in the bathroom, very sick. And he would just be with me. Like I would be laying on the ground and he would just curl up next to me almost. It's okay, mom. Like I'm right here. Like we'll get through it together. So people ask me all the time, like, how did you get through all of that? My dog.
Well, you know, they say the dog is the only animal that loves you more than it loves itself.
Yeah, seriously. I would take day trips with him. He was such a huge outlet for me. I brought him everywhere with me. He was almost a comfort thing. And then later on down the road, after I had joined peer support for my department so I could help other officers who went through shootings, I was actually going to go through the process of getting him to be a support dog for... Yep. So if there was a shooting that happened, you can take him to the station for other officers to pet him. And then, I don't know, I was trying to get him to join with me so we could be like a power duo. Because I just figured he gave me so much relief and just love. I wanted him to give it to other people. So
I'm going to back up here just a little bit. You mentioned two lawsuits. Why were there two lawsuits brought by the family of the guy?
So one of them was, I believe it's like something like I was racist, basically, like racial profiling, and that's why I shot him. And then the other one was his estate. So they had his daughter, who I think she was a minor, maybe. And so they had the daughter file a lawsuit against me. I know that sounds horrible because I'm in the middle of the lawsuit, but I try not to pay attention to it because it's all noise. And for me, I just show up, I get, I do my depo, and then I just wait. So one of them was actually kicked out. And then we're still waiting on the appeal of one of them. So for right now, we're actually waiting for the Supreme Court to decide if they're going to take it on to make the final decision or if they're going to be kicking it back to the Ninth Circuit of California.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Does that have to do with qualified immunity?
Whether if I'm safe or not from qualified immunity.
Right. Do you still have that protection or no? Because it was taken away from you, right?
So I believe it was under a lot of discussion if I was still going to have qualified immunity, and I do. I still have qualified immunity. I'm safe in that aspect. I was acting lawfully and under the scope of my duties 100%. Right. So that I was really assured that it's fine. Everything's okay. But again, there's so much stress because it wasn't an easy decision, that guys. It was a very long, like years. So of course, I'm going through all this stress. So really quick, if you're going through a lot of stress and you're noticing signs that your body is deteriorating, go to the hospital. Don't pull a Tony. You can't muscle through it. Just go.
In law enforcement, we call that a clue.
Exactly. I ignored all the clues and I was... fine, I'm okay. And then I'm half dead and I'm like, okay, I need help. So
yeah. Well, I thought I read an article where the Ninth Judicial District out there, the federal judicial district, took qualified immunity away from you in an appellate decision.
No. So I believe I read that too, but then I called my lawyer immediately and I was like, what is up with this? And he goes, No. He clarified it for me and he goes, no, you're actually totally safe. They are not actually saying what happened. They're just trying to stir it up. And I was, okay, good. Yeah, I'm glad that's it. Why didn't you call me before this ruling or whatever? And he goes, no, you're fine. You're good. You're good. And I was, okay.
Well,
sounds good.
You know what, ladies and gentlemen, that's a perfect example why you do your own research to find out what the facts were. Because here I am. I read one article without doing my research. I'm the guy that preaches this all the time and just found out that it's an erroneous article.
No, you're fine, honestly. Like, and the news is so corrupt. And it's so funny because they always say the police department is corrupt. Our news outlets are. Absolutely. Like 100%. So,
I mean, think about it. They've got to sell the news articles to get more advertising. Selling stories that sell papers or bring viewers in leads to more advertisers, which leads to more money for the company, the media company. And that's what this is all about. They don't give a crap about telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. You heard it here, guys.
Yes, you did. And they've heard it. Believe me, they've heard it multiple times from Murph. So what was the treatment for your medical conditions? Because I've seen you on social media not that long ago, and you were in a rough condition.
Yeah. So When I first got diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, I was hospitalized for, I believe, 5 days. And again, I was never in the hospital prior to that. It was my first time being hospitalized. So I spent 5 days in the hospital. I started a infusion called Remicade. And that one worked great for me. I responded really well to it. I was on it for about a year. And then I believe it was the day after my birthday, I went in for my normal infusion and I stopped breathing during the infusion.
Well, that's not good.
So, and it was kind of, you got to laugh at it. Oh, well. So for me, I was always the youngest person in the infusion room. It was always a lot of older people getting their infusions. So when I got there, the nurses knew me. It was always these two nurses, and I'd always be like, hey, what's up? And then my happy-go-lucky self. And every single time for a year, I would go in every 4 weeks, and I was always, no, I don't need anything. I'll go get my own water. I'll get my own food tray. Don't worry about me. And then when I came in that day, I was totally hanging out, was chilling, and then I started to not breathe. And I just remember looking over at the nurse's desk with my eyes wide open, and the nurse is looking at me like, oh, she's not okay. She's not okay. And he runs over and I think he hit me with like Benadryl or like Epi or something. I forgot what it was. And then I slowly was able to be like, and I can breathe.
Oh my goodness. I'm not breathing here listening to you tell this story.
So the funny part about that, when I say the police academy trains you for everything, they train you for everything. So I went through the gas house and you know, when you're going through the gas, they're going to tell you, hey, it's really itching you, it's burning, you can't breathe, but trust me, you can breathe. It just gives you the effect that you can't. So when I was in the infusion room and I couldn't breathe, I just thought to myself, I'm in a safe spot. Don't freak out. You're in the hospital. Yeah, you can't breathe, but they see you and they're coming. So I actually remained calm because I knew I'll be fine.
So, oh my gosh.
So it worked out. And then they were, do you want to retry the drug? I'm like, nah, yeah. I don't want to try that again. So then after that, I tried, I believe, three other treatments. And the other ones I've tried, I'm trying to remember the names. We have Entyvio, Remicade, Stelara. So I tried all of those and none of them worked. I'm currently on Rinvoq, which is a daily pill. And long story short, I tried getting off of that one because you're supposed to lower your dose. My body is so severe from my condition that I have to have the higher dose. So, and then I talked to my doctor and he's like, yeah, you can't be on that dose for a really long time because it's going to cause other problems. Like it's really not safe for you. So coming up in the next couple months or pretty soon, probably a couple of weeks, I'm going to have to try to figure out another treatment. But I'm running out of options. I only have one more after this. Mm. And then we'll see. Because they keep talking about taking out my intestines. And I'm like, swipe or no swipe. No, you're not going to take it. And yeah, so we'll figure it out. But
you know what? I mean, you're such an inspiration to me. And I know a lot of the listeners because of everything that you've gone through and you're continuing to go through. And you can still sit back and laugh about it. I know it's a
only
defense
now.
Mechanism.
Only
now, you say?
I would just say only now. Like there were times in the middle of it where if you ever talk to my beloved husband, Dylan, I always tell him, I wish I had met him sooner. I wish I had met him during the shooting and then all the way up to when I met him in November. We met online. He slid in my DMs on Instagram. He was a follower. And anyways, but I always tell him, baby, I wish I had you because you would have helped and you would have saved me so much heartache because I wasn't okay during that time. And so many people back then were like, wow, like she still has her spark. She still has her light. And I can actually pinpoint exactly in my Instagram where I lost my light and where I started, I don't want to say faking being happy, but it didn't come really natural to me. And I think just now I started to find my little spark again because you know what? You got to laugh at everything. Like, right. I know it sucks, but like, it's okay. Like during my pregnancy, I was not okay. I know we're jumping around and I'm sorry, maybe I should hold off on this.
No, this is good.
But I, through all of those years and everything that I've gone through, I've never given up. I never, ever once gave up. But it was during my pregnancy, it was December of 2024. I was in so much pain. I refused all treatment, anything possible because my condition was really severe and I was losing so much weight. And I was in so much pain that I was literally pregnant and I would just collapse on the ground. And my husband would say, baby, let me move you to the couch. Like, and I was like, no, just leave me here. Just put a blanket over me. I can't move anymore. I can't. And my husband's like, come on, you have to fight. You have to keep going. And I looked at him and I said, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I can't keep doing this. And I will never forget his face because he was so let down. And he was, no, it's okay. And for him, he said, it's okay, baby. Like, I have enough faith and I have enough strength for the both of us. I'll carry you. So during this time, I'm so sorry. I'm crying because during this time, before we got pregnant, we were told, you can't have kids because of your condition if you're not on all these infusions and drugs, and then maybe you'll have a chance. And I was, no, I don't trust your drugs. There's no, every single drug I try, I have a bad reaction. And that's why I keep burning through all these drugs. And so I'm not going to be pregnant. I don't know what it's going to do. So I was on no drugs. I refused everything. And during this time, we just didn't know if the baby, sweet Henry, was growing properly or if he was going to come out with, you know, deformities or special needs. Like, we had no idea. And so I was under so much stress and I was just so exhausted fighting every day. When you have a disease, it's not like, oh, it's only 12 hours. It's the entire day. It's every single day. So that was so hard for me during my pregnancy. And we kept my pregnancy private. We actually didn't tell anybody until I was 8 weeks out. That's when I announced it. And that's the only time I gave up. I told my husband, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. And he just looked at me. He's like, so what? You're not going to try anymore? And I'm like, no, I'm tired. I don't want to anymore. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if anybody has ever met my husband, like at SHOT Show or anything, he is the kindest, most sweetest person in the world. He has all the strength that will carry us both when I don't have it.
You got to quit talking so good about it because he's a fireman.
I know. He's a fireman. He's a hero.
Dylan, I say what, man? You're changing my opinion of fireman here. I can't believe it. I mean, you
he's
guys,
a cutie.
When the rest of us are out there working the streets, you guys are getting your sleep. And the listeners, it's all in fun. It's like busting on the FBI. You just do it because it's easy and it's just out of fun.
Exactly. Exactly. Or else I wouldn't have married one.
Exactly. Well, then that's still questionable. I talked to your dad about that and he couldn't figure it out either. But
oh, if you want to hear a quick story, when I told my dad, oh, you guys will laugh at this. Okay. So when I told my dad, hey, so I'm actually kind of dating, maybe seeing this guy, but he lives in Northern California. So it's 5 hours away from us. But he's a fireman. And the first thing my dad said was, he's got a family. He's lying to you.
Oh, way to go, Jamie.
So then he's getting in my head. And I was like, no, I don't think so. I've talked to his siblings and they don't really say anything. And he's like, nope, he's got a family. That guy's lying to you, Tony. And I was like, oh my gosh. So when I first came up here, my now husband, Dylan, we were just dating, and I come up to his house and I'd be talking to him and I'm opening drawers and he's like, I'm looking and he goes, what are you doing? And I'm looking for photos of your family. And he goes, like my parents? And I'm like, no, do you have a wife and kids? And he's like, no, I told you that. Like, what are you? And I was, yeah, I'm just kidding.
Oh, this is hilarious.
Yeah. So I'm texting my dad. I'm like, freaking, why'd you tell me that?
Oh, man. Dylan, good job, brother. Seriously, all kidding aside, the bravest of the brave still needs a little pick-me-up every once in a while. You know, and
or he drags me.
Well, you know, and listeners, I mean, I've known Tony now for roughly 4 years. I would have never suspected that she would have ever thought that. I mean, you can see from her personality and her attitude, she's got a can-do attitude. And look at the crap she went through and still has a can-do attitude. But now, Tony, that illness resulted in something that you never wanted to happen. Can you tell us about that?
Well, again, it was from the stress of the shooting and everything else being in the news, the death threats, being transferred, no public contact, and then even just dealing with other coworkers. All of that stress really built up. So when I got diagnosed, they were telling me, okay, you have ulcerative colitis. It's not curable, but it's manageable. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm 23 years old. I just got notified that I have a disease that I can't cure and it's with me the rest of my life. And your life is now forever changed. And I remember thinking for the first couple of years, I was in remission. So I would do good every other year. I would be good health and then decline and then really good and then decline. But during the time that I was actually in remission, I just had this idea in my head where I'm like, oh, I can keep this going for like 10 years. I'm healthy. I can do this. I'm figuring some stuff out. And it wasn't until the week before we actually got married, that's when we had the doctor's appointment where they told us about the whole kid situation. And I told my husband, hey, I know you want a big family. You're the oldest of six and you want a big family of yourself. I was like, it's okay if you want to not marry me. I want you to be happy. I want you to have that family and it's okay. And he goes, are you freaking serious? He's like, he looks at me and he's like, you're so lame. And I'm like, oh, okay. We were both angry at the doctors, but he was like, nah, we'll figure it out. There's always a way. And I'm like, okay, I guess we got married. It changes your life completely. Every single day I'm dealing with it. And even if I'm healthy, I'm still dealing with it. And what annoys me so much is that if I'll post a photo of me smiling, happy, of me on a walk with a stroller, people, I just had somebody the other day comment, they're like, wow, you look pretty healthy for somebody who has a disease where you pensioned out. And I'm like, oh boy, you have no idea what I've gone through. And I just went to the hospital in November or maybe a month before that. And I did 17 days in the hospital. And then I just got hospitalized again in January for another 10 days. So, but here I am, what are we in, March? And I look healthy though, because I got makeup on. No, I'm just kidding.
You look like your old self.
Thank you. I've worked so hard to get back to my old self. It might be the fake clip-ins, but I'll take it because I lost all my hair.
Hey, maybe I could borrow those, you know? I don't know. What do you think?
I got you. We just got a color analysis and we'll get you matched up.
You got any white ones?
Ooh, maybe some color dye. But yeah, one of the sad things about being diseased is that I actually lost more than half my hair a couple months ago.
Wow.
And that was really hard for me. Even to this day where I tell my husband, I just miss having hair. And he's, you're still beautiful. And I'm like, don't lie to me. I know I have no hair.
But well, you know what they say, love is blind, right?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so.
But what about your career though?
So with being sick, like and this is what always makes me cry, but
I'm sorry I'm making you cry today.
It's all right. You got to get it out one way or the other, right? So I try to hang on to it for so long. Like I didn't want to leave the department. I didn't. You have no idea. I tried so hard. Like I would drive into work when I was so sick and I would barely make it. And then I would have I had a couple sergeants like pull me aside and they were like, hey, look, why are you not making it to roll call? And I'm no, like, I'm just really sick. Like I'll be in the bathroom or in the locker room really sick. And they'd be like, okay. I had one of them. Okay. Well, can you just try to make it to roll call? And then it got to the point where I would go to roll call. And then within 5 minutes, I'm getting up, getting attention and then walking out because I'm sick. And I got so done being humiliated that all the eyes were on me and I'm, yeah, I'm sick. Gotta go. Wow. And so I just straight up told them, I need you to just give me some grace. I'm not faking it, but people will see this and think, oh, you're healthy. You're okay.
Yeah,
but that's not the case at all. So I tried hanging on to it. I never wanted to leave. I never imagined myself leaving. I always figured I would be doing all these amazing, incredible things on the department. There was never a second option. There was never a backup plan, guys. My only plan was LAPD. And then people ask me like, oh, would you just join another department? No, I have LAPD in my blood. I'm going to be LAPD. I'm LAPD proud. And to this day, even after everything they did to me, I still love the LAPD. I grew up with them. How can I ever hate them? It's just a bad relationship, I guess.
Well, yeah, but your dad's position is being he's the head of the police union, right? Mm-hmm. So he's always butting heads with headquarters. Yes.
And I actually felt the brute end of it because I don't know if I can talk too much about this, but the chief of police at the time, you can tell he did not like me. And he didn't. The whole thing with LAPD is the department loves you until the news writes an article about you. Now you're drawing attention to the department and now the department does not like you. And they try to bury you because they do not want attention. They don't want to be in the news. So because I was in the news a lot, a certain somebody high up had a vendetta against me. And because of my last name, that 100%, I think, played a role in it.
Yeah.
So it was challenging. But I remember my dad's the most supportive person ever. But when I had to tell my parents, I don't think I can do this anymore. I'm not getting any better with my health. And me working, it's like as a police officer, it's making me worse because I'm just constantly, it's in that fight or flight mode. And when you have a disease, it really plays a lot into it.
Right.
So when I actually told my parents, they were against it. They were like, yeah, no, you're fine. My dad has the mentality of always push through. Whatever it is, just push through. You have to push through. And my dad always, you know, I was brought up being told never depend on a man. You need to make your own money. And so for me to tell my dad, hey, I'm too sick. I can't do it anymore. And at this time I believe I was about to get married. My dad was, so you're going to depend on a man? Absolutely not. You need to work. This is your career. We had a plan. You were going to do all these amazing things. And it was really hard on my dad. And I know he just wants the best for me. My dad and I are best friends. But I remember it was a really lonely time for me because I felt I was letting down my parents and I was letting down a lot of people online, which is why I never talked about me retiring because I didn't want to let anybody down because I have so many messages of little girls who would say, hey, I'm dressed up as a police officer. I'm pretending to be you. I want to be a police officer when I grow up. You showed me that women can be police officers. And I felt so ashamed letting them down because I still wanted to be that image for them and to show them, no, you still can do it. But then it's, look at me now. I'm sick. Now I can't. So what message does that send? You can do the job until you're sick and then you can't. I had such a hard time talking about it that I just never really addressed it.
Yeah. And those people that send you those comments, they never have the guts to do that to your face. I told you in some of our text messages back and forth that I get hate mail on social media from people who probably weren't even alive when Pablo Escobar was. So they really don't know their butt from a hole in the ground, but they're really brave on social media.
Oh,
but
so
I haven't had a single person come and say it to my face. Not a single one.
Yeah.
So I don't know who was sending those messages, but shame on you, you know?
Yeah. All the mean people, but the nice people, I'll take that. Thank you.
Oh yeah.
I actually had really quick during that time, I had so much support from the public, not just from LA, believe it or not, the loud, annoying people that hate the police. They're a small group, but they're very loud. But yep. I was getting so much love. I have every single letter that was sent to me. People from all different states, they didn't know really where I was, which station. So I had some letters sent to Newton Division, and then some was sent to headquarters. And then they were transferred over to whatever division I was at. And I kept every single letter. Any letter you guys sent me, I still have it to this day where they said, we're so proud of you. I'm so sorry you went through this. We're sending you love. You have our support. And those letters just brought me through everything. I wish that other officers who go through the same thing that I went through, I wish they could have experienced that because the woman telling me that, thank you so much for saving me. And then all of these letters, it just was, okay. I know I'm hanging in there. I can hold on. I know I'm making a difference and it's okay. So if you send a letter, thank you.
So nice of people to do that, to take the time, you know, and I had a question written down here. I'll just read it. Is there a moment in your career, maybe something happened before or after the shooting that changed the way you see people forever? And you just answered that. I mean, you're still positive. You're still presenting. There are certain factions that we've talked about here already on the show, and they do not deserve to be mentioned again. They should be non-entities in our lives. But, I mean, you're still coming across with a very positive attitude, a very can-do attitude. We all have our weak days, but you still got that can-do. I'm going to beat this. I'm not going to go down. I'm not going to stop fighting. I'm never going to give up.
Right. Thank you.
I love it. It's motivational. It is to me.
So I don't know. I think you mentioned earlier you're a little bit religious, right?
Yeah, I'm a Christian.
Okay. So I can't really quote it because I'm terrible at that, but there's a passage in the Bible where someone in the Bible says, send me, Lord, send me. And every single shift, I would always pray to God and say, Lord, if something bad was going to happen, please use me and send me. If you have to take my life, leave somebody else's. And I really just dug into that. And after the shooting, I kept thinking to myself, Lord, thank you for using me because I wouldn't want another officer to go through this. And I know physically my body can't, and I guess mentally too, because that's what kind of caused the disease. But I used to thank God for using me, because I would never want somebody else to handle this. And I just remember thinking, I can take this. I can do this. I can take everything that's coming on my way. I can do it. And it's all because of the Lord. There's no way I would have been able to handle any of this.
I'm with you, sister. Absolutely. People think this is your story, and I certainly don't mean to take away from it. People ask me, I'm not a tough guy. I've never pretended to be a tough guy. My partner, Javier Pena, wasn't either. We were dedicated to our professions. We have very strong work ethics, just like you do. We know how to successfully reach a conclusion to whatever operation you're working on, but that doesn't really make you a tough guy. But through everything we went through in Colombia and the shootings and the mayhem and the tortures and everything that was going on down there, they say, how do you survive? How did I survive? Only by the grace of God. Mm-hmm. Only by the grace of God are you here talking to me today. So you always have a platform here to talk about your faith. This is occasionally I get hate mail about that. Well, my response to that is go listen to another podcast, because right. I'm not going to shy away from my faith. I'm not going to deny my Lord, and you're not either.
Right. Amen.
Good stuff. I did want to ask you, this is a severe form of PTSD that you're going through. This is one of the most severe forms I've ever heard about. Do you go through counseling? Did you, and are you still?
So you know what's funny about that is that after the shooting, I've never seen the therapist or anything of that sort. And then I told my attorney who I was assigned to, I was like, hey, like I'm going through a lot of stress. I have, I've been dealing with a lot of things. I need to go talk to somebody. And he goes, yeah, that's not a good idea. Whatever you say, it can be used in court. So he's like, I'm advising against it. Do not go talk to somebody. You can't talk to a therapist. And I was like, what? And I'm like, nah, I need to go talk to somebody. So I actually have this therapist. And
I can't believe that. Have they never heard of their doctor-patient confidentiality?
Nah, I don't know, man. So he told me straight up, like, no, you should not talk to anybody. Anything can be subpoenaed. You have lawsuits. Don't do it. And I was at the point where I was like, no, I need to talk to somebody. I can't just brush this under the rug. This is a serious incident. So I ended up finding a therapist, and I love her to death. She was never the person that'd be like, so how does that make you feel?
Yeah.
What's going on? No, she would be like, oh, that's wild. Tell me more. I loved her so much. She's amazing. So I actually saw her, I think, I'm not going to say the amount, but I saw her quite often after the shooting. And then I don't really talk to her as much now because I've healed a lot of it, but she was just fantastic. So my advice to anybody out there is just go talk to somebody. Find the right one, though. You definitely need to find the right therapist. But yes. She healed me so much. Like, just like on a personal level, I was dealing with dating stuff, some silly stuff like that. But then also the professional stuff. He was so amazing. So just go out there. And guess what? You don't have to tell anybody if you're embarrassed. When I started dating my husband, I would say, oh, I'm going to go have a meeting with my friend. That was her name, the friend. And so he would just always be like, okay. And then he's like, so how'd it go with your friend? I'm like, great. I feel awesome.
We're getting close to the end here. I've still got so much I'd want to ask you, but I'm not going to waste your time.
No, we can do speed questions.
Well, do you think, you know what? Actually, I have rapid fire questions here. It's the first time I've ever done it on the interview.
Let's do it.
Let's go right over there. So these are rapid fire questions. What's the most dangerous call officers respond to now?
I would say traffic stops, because you don't really know what's in the vehicle.
Agreed.
Or domestic violence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because they hate each other till you get there, and then they both hate you.
Yup.
Biggest myth about police shootings.
Oh, gosh. That you can just stop the clock whenever you want, think about it, and then respond. Everybody thinks that we're robots. We're not robots. Look at me, okay? There's nothing robot about this.
There you go.
Come on.
I like it. Something Hollywood gets wrong about cops. Everything.
They're all corrupt. Every single movie, we're all corrupt. I was just watching The Lincoln Lawyer. Great. It's on Netflix. I really like it. But it's all the cops are corrupt. And I'm like, no, that doesn't happen. And then something that really bothers me is that the clicking of the gun whenever you're out of ammunition, it goes click, click, click. In real life, that doesn't happen. It's a spongy trigger. So that also annoys me.
Yeah. Plus your slides are locked back.
Right.
One piece of gear every officer relies on.
Gun. I said, you know what's funny though? Growing up, my dad always said it was the pen because you have to write reports. You got to write everything. If you don't have the pen, you don't got nothing. And I'm like,
that's right.
Ooh, well, I don't think a pen was going to save me that day.
But it is afterwards.
Yeah, afterwards.
Last one, hardest part of being a cop today.
Oh my gosh. I feel like we talked about this, but I would say the stigma that is on us, that we're all racist, that we don't love anybody, that it's the whole brotherhood. That couldn't be far from the truth. It's so stupid to me. People who say that they're anti-cop, all cops are bad, BLM, you're so stupid. I can't stand you. Just, and what's so sad is that I grew up with these certain cousins and they know my family. They love us so much. And then when BLM was all big, they were all posting BLM, anti-cop. And then I get into my shooting. I have not spoken to them since. I straight up was, I'm your cousin. You know who I am. You know my values. You know I'm not a racist. And they're like, oh, well, nope, you're done. You're out of my life. I'm very quick to that. If I just can't stand it. I'm not going to have that negativity in my life. And now some people will say, oh, you're not going to be friends with anybody that has opposing views. Oh, no, I do. But then if you're an idiot, I'm like, goodbye.
In today's society, nobody wants to discuss something. Yeah, I've got a Patreon subscriber channel, which is patreon.com/gameofcrimes for all you folks out there to get that cheesy commercial in. But if you don't agree with what they say, they get mad and they cancel you or they unblock you or block you or stop following you, whatever all that stuff is that they do. I'm still learning about social media. And I keep telling them, it's okay to have a difference of opinion. That doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. We don't have to be enemies. Jeez, yeah, it's crazy.
I think for me, it was more of, it was so personal and it was my family. And right. For me, I cannot surround myself with people who truly believe down to their core that police officers are evil. If I know myself, I know my father, my sister, we would all give up our lives to protect an innocent. And for them to say that, I don't need you in my life. Goodbye.
Yep. I'm with you. All right. So do you think police officers today might be more hesitant to react because they're concerned about the aftermath and the things that you went through?
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. I mean, not even just what I'm going through, but they see how the public, they have this perception of us and you are guilty right off the bat. There is no, hey, you're going to have your time and you're going to give out all the facts. They already made up their mind before all the facts are out there. And that's what's so disgusting about our society now is that they just don't have any respect for law enforcement and what we're willing to give up, which is our lives. At the end of the day, people, no matter how many times I say that, they don't understand.
No, they don't believe it. Yeah. Go look at the law enforcement memorial wall in Washington, D.C. There's more than a few names on there. So when you look back at your career years from now, what is it that you hope people remember about Tony McBride as a police officer?
How much I cared, probably, and how much I loved all of them, all the people. Oh, you're getting me to cry again. Stop. I honestly, the people that have worked with me, there were obviously times where I had bad days of being benched and I was grumpy for sure, but it was very, very few of those days. I've tried so hard being positive. I tried decorating the inside of the station during holidays, brought in goodie bags on police, what was called police days or whatever.
Police week.
Thank you. I made goodie bags. They weren't cheap, but I did everything I could to just try to love on all the officers. And then I remember working patrol. I would have so many people tell me, wow, you're not like the typical police officer. You're super energetic. You show a lot of your personality. And that meant a lot to me because I also had a lot of commendations from citizens saying, you know, you went above and beyond for me. Like, thank you for not doing like the bare minimum. Like I really felt that. So I hope that when Henry gets older, I really hope that he'll know how hard I worked and how much I loved the job. But most importantly, like, it was a huge honor for me to wear the badge.
Absolutely. I'm with you 100% on everything you said there. Pretty much on everything you said for the last couple of days here we've been talking. So before I let you go, before we wrap this thing up, do you have any words of wisdom or advice for anyone's considering a career in law enforcement, maybe especially women or military or any high risk job? Or, and is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want to talk about?
Oh, gosh. Anybody who's thinking about being a police officer, despite everything that I have said, my advice to you is still do it. Please go out there and do it. It is the best job in the entire world. I don't care what happened to me. Yeah, it sucked. I got a disease out of it. My stress level through the roof. But still, guys, I'm serious. It is the most rewarding job ever in this entire earth. You are helping people. You're saving lives. Please, if you're even thinking about it, go do it. Go through the academy. If you realize in the academy, it's not for you. Okay, tap out and quit, whatever. I had classmates that were like that, but do it. It's so rewarding. And yeah, there's times where it's really scary, but you're supposed to have your partner there. You're supposed to have all these other police officers with you. So my advice to you is go out there and do it, but train. Make sure you understand fully that your life can be taken and it's your job to protect others. So don't take it lightly. Go out there and train, work out, eat clean, like dedicate your whole life into it. And then my other advice is that, I don't know if this makes sense, but I used to tell myself, like, you have to love the job more than the hate you're going to get, because you're going to get a whole lot of hate. And your love for the job has to be way more than that, or else it's going to eat you alive. And for me, it was always an honor putting on my uniform. Like, when I would put on that uniform, I truly felt not only like a badass, but I felt invincible, meaning like I could run into gunfire. I felt, yeah, use me. I wasn't always scared in that sense. So my advice is just love the job. Even when it's hard, you still got to love it.
And I would just add on that, we're all scared. It's just, I think the good Lord gives certain people certain gifts. Mm-hmm. And law enforcement, I think he gives us the ability to deal with being scared and still think logically so that you can survive the situation and you can save other people. Mm-hmm. So as simple as those words are, but, you know, you're one of the most motivational people I've had on the show here. There was a young lady that was on a couple weeks ago, Mary Howe, that she was the same way. You two could be sisters. You kind of look a lot like as well. And she was in the Air Force. Her dad was a member of the Delta Force in the Army. He was in the Battle of Mogadishu. And her grandfather was Charlie Beckwith, who founded the Delta Force in the U.S. Army. So she's got a legacy there. And of everything that she went through, she's come out positive on the other end. And that's what you're doing here. So, Dan, did I miss anything that you wanted to mention today? Because this is your story.
Oh, gosh. I might have skipped over a couple things, guys. So that just means I'll have to come back and then, you know, Murph and I will talk about it. But yeah, I mean, if you guys follow my story, I'm on Instagram mostly at Tony McBride Official, and I'll be jumping back on YouTube here shortly, just waiting for my health to get a little bit better. But on my Instagram, I do mostly everything. I give you guys daily updates. I talk about everything now. Since I'm not with the department, I can speak freely and I'm not scared of having them come after me.
And for you listeners out there, you didn't see me while she was talking, but I'm giving her two thumbs up about coming back on the show. Send me messages. Let me know. If you want to hear from Tony again, let me know. Put it in the comments on YouTube, or if you're listening to this on audio, go to gameofcrimespodcast.com. Send me your messages there. My email is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. So show Tony some love. First of all, go check her out on Instagram. If you're not following her, she's got well over 100,000 followers on there. So she's, I think Murph's up to 12. So, and that's not 12,000, that's 12. Maybe a couple more. But show her some love. Go over and follow her. I mean, if you need words of inspiration, do you want to see somebody who's been there and done that, who's been to hell and back and is still continue to smile and laugh about it? Here's the person. So, Tony, I can't thank you enough. Again, on Instagram, it's Tony. And Tony is T-O-N-I, not Y.
Correct. Yeah, because I'm not a guy.
We never thought that. And she told you you're coming back on Facebook, did you say?
Mm-hmm. So I'm on Instagram and I have a Facebook, but I'll be coming back on YouTube really short.
YouTube. There you go. So that's Tony McBride Official. Tony, thank you so much for your service. Thank you for your transparency. Thank you for the sacrifices that you've made for your community, your fellow man. You know, the Bible says there's no greater love hath any person that they're willing to lay their life down for their fellow man. And you were willing to do that. The reception that you received because of your bravery and standing up and doing the job that you swore an oath to do It's pathetic, it's asinine, and it's ridiculous what you went through, including the department's reaction. And that liberal board of directors, go on a ride along. In fact, this is advice for anybody. You don't like the cops? Go on a ride along and see what they go through. Then you'll get firsthand, first person knowledge on what they deal with every freaking day. And it's not sitting around drinking coffee and eating donuts. I bet Tony doesn't even eat donuts. And that's like required to be a cop.
I miss donuts. I can't have gluten anymore. Oh, it's okay. I kind of smell a donut and I'm like, good times. I miss you.
But it's truly, thank you for giving us an inside look of what really goes on in law enforcement.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you. It truly, and guys, I don't think you understand. Murph has been trying to get me on his podcast for a very long time now, but my health has been up and down and I was like, I can't do it. So guys, please, if you liked this episode, please thank him for having me on here and working so hard to get me on here. It was hard work. So thank you. And thank you. I haven't talked about any of this freely. So it was great to just have a conversation and letting my story out there.
Well, you know what? I'm honored that you came on. I mean, you saw when we first started, I was giddy. I had goosebumps. So I finally got you on the show here, and it truly is an honor. And, you know, we'll stop patting each other on the back here in a minute, everybody, but this is a special episode as far as I'm concerned. And you know what, to everyone that's listening out there, this is the reality behind the badge. None of this is made up. I mean, you hear what people go through. You hear me bring heroes on here all the time. You're looking at a hero today. She's shaking her head no. But that's the true sign of a hero, because they don't know that they're a hero and they'll never admit that they're a hero. So thank you guys so much for coming back every week the way you do. Show Tony some love. If you haven't checked us out, if you're listening to this on audio, go over to YouTube and check me out there. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar, hit the subscribe button. I'm trying to grow the channel over there. We're doing fairly good by my standards. But there's always room for growth. I don't understand why you guys continue to come back every week, but actually I do. And that was because of Tony today. It's because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And that's our game of crimes. God bless you all. Stay safe out there. I'll see you next week.
Bye, guys. Take care.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.